Welcome to our Friday Five Live podcast hosted by Meg Foster. Meg has spent 20 years in higher education focused on student success initiatives and working in areas such as orientation, faculty development, online learning, student leadership, and first-year initiatives.
Welcome everyone to our Friday Five Live for October. We are so lucky to be joined by Melissa Carlton, our legal expert extraordinaire on all things higher ed related. Melissa joins us from Ohio, where she is a partner and higher education chair at Bricker Graydon LLP. She advises higher education entities in a variety of areas, including student affairs, student conduct, disability accommodation, student confidentiality, policies, contracts, governance, accreditation, and employment matters. And Melissa is just an incredible resource who's been kind enough to come on quarterly with us this year, 2025. This is our last of this series for this year, but we're hoping you had enough fun, Melissa, that you'll come back for 2026. And talk with us about all things kind of legal issues in the world of higher education. If you're joining us today, normally we have Melissa Durant on with us, and unfortunately she is under the weather, but please do use the chat to introduce yourselves. I'm seeing a number of folks hopping in to let us know where they're listening from today. If I've prepared questions for Melissa to guide our conversation, though there's been some late breaking things in the last, a few days that have given us a whole new set of things to discuss as well, but we love your questions and welcome those. Just make sure that you select everyone from the drop-down menu so that we can all see your questions. We'll weave those into our conversation today. And as a reminder, this is a podcast, so it will be available to all of our GoTo Knowledge members, but you can also find us on all major podcasting platforms. So I like to think we pair nicely with a cup of tea, cup of coffee, or a good walk. Sometimes movement is medicine, and sometimes it's helpful. So today, again, grateful to have Melissa with us as we talk about courtrooms to campuses, navigating an ever-changing legal terrain in the world of higher education. So Melissa, thank you for being on with us today.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me on such a difficult and challenging conversation topic.
Yeah, well, right. And I've prepared these questions, and always it's interesting to try to prepare questions that you think, well, does this anticipate everything that's going to change? And then inevitably, something like, a campus compact message gets sent out impacting nine institutions, including two that Melissa and I have been connected to. But just to kind of kick us off, we've seen so much going on since July, which was the last time we spoke with one another. And, everything from Harvard's funding freeze to the continuation of First Amendment discussions and actions on campus. Walk us through anything that's happened kind of since July that's prevailed and any things that we should be paying particular attention to.
I feel like you have just thrown spaghetti at me and asked to straighten all the noodles. So how do we describe what's happened since July? I will just say, in your questions today, I think the First Amendment runs through all of it. And I think that's really the headline in higher ed right now. Everything comes back to two things. One is First Amendment, and the other is how we're going to enforce things at higher ed level. And so from a First Amendment, the way they intertwine is the government seems to be applying funding to speech in a way that people are arguing violates First Amendment rights. And so those two things are coming together. This is not unique to higher education. We've seen this in protests all over the country. We've seen this in the way that ICE has been addressing individuals. We've seen some, restrictions of people coming back into the country because of things that they may have said on social media. This is kind of pervading all the different areas of the government. So we're seeing lots of different lawsuits on how First Amendment rights can be not enforced. I mean, the individuals bringing the lawsuits obviously are trying to enforce their own First Amendment rights and to protect those. But the federal government is maybe the argument would be that they're steamrolling some First Amendment rights in order to achieve ends that may or may not be consistent with the First Amendment. And so, you know, with Harvard, there has been this ongoing series of complaints where Harvard has sued the federal government for all sorts of things now. And frankly, I'm getting lost in the Harvard case because there have been so many different ways in which the federal government has sought to affect the way Harvard does business. Right? We're talking about Title VI and going through you know, foreign gifts and now the financial composite score, you know, heightened cash monitoring, things like that. Like, we're just looking at so many different ways that they are going in and trying to enforce things with Harvard in a manner that may be interfering with how Harvard is choosing to do its business and what may be encroaching on their general, you know, First Amendment rights to speak and their employees' First Amendment rights to speak. So, you know, that's the kind of the touch point case that we're seeing, but this goes into everything. You see the tendrils in the rest of your questions. Title VI, it's really what can protesters say and not say? Where is the boundary, right, of that? And when does it start becoming something that the institution must go in and enforce? And then how do we address that, particularly on a public campus where the institution is a public entity that has to, you know, be cognizant of First Amendment rights? It's just so intertwined with everything. So, you know, the basic right, First Amendment says in relevant part, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. So Congress can make no law, but obviously the if the Congress makes a law and then we try to enforce it in a way that would abridge the freedom of speech, then that creates problems too. And I think that's the meat of where all of the disputes are. It's not that Congress saying, thou shalt not say, and then passing a law that says that. It's more that Congress says, you can't discriminate on the basis of race. And the U.S. Department of Education says, well, that means you can't say the following things, right? And that's where we get into those things. So when we look at it from a First Amendment standpoint, the government can address the time, place, and manner of speech to make sure that it's not disruptive. But there are very strict requirements on the content, how the federal government can regulate the content of the speech. And that is where we're seeing the crash right now. Government is trying to regulate the content of the speech, arguably. This is what the cases are about. And people are saying, you're regulating the content of my speech. That is a First Amendment. That is a First Amendment violation. And, you know, on the back end, federal government is using it as an excuse to remove federal funding in ways that's been really disruptive of higher education and allowing them to continue forward with their programs for the benefit of their students and their communities.
I just actually spoke with somebody today who had a Title III grant removed for one night that they had, you know, that discussed diversity. And so that was, you know, the loss of $2 million to support student success. And that's one example at one institution. I know there's so many out there. And then, you know, we're also seeing, of course, the post Charlie Kirk assassination and removal of people from I think I'd even read that a student had been removed from an institution with regards to comments that they had made on a social media post. So
we're seeing a lot of that. There seems to have been some, you know, defined or you know, group of people that were going after Charlie Kirk related social media. Sorry, apparently my dogs have opinions to offer too.
We welcome all opinions here, two-legged, four-legged.
As long as they're polite. So yeah, I've seen a lot of contacts, you know, because I work with a lot of different entities. So you start to see that the people that are complaining about some of the Charlie Kirk media, social media comments are actually using the same forms to do it, which suggests a concerted effort, which doesn't negate it, you know, being a concern that's raised by many people. It just gives us a little bit of insight into how that is being pulled together.
That is very interesting. Okay, so it's perhaps an effort that is more organized than First Amendment.
Yeah, not uncommon, right? But yeah, anytime that someone is you know, saying something, the problem is it's a fine line between political speech and something that someone might consider harassing. And I think what we're seeing now on campuses is the blurring of that line, which again goes back to the speech, whether speech is appropriate, whether it's protected under the First Amendment, can be in the eye of the beholder. And that's what makes this complicated.
So when you're advising, this is not one of our questions, but just curious, you know, I know So many of us have, of course, campus policies that we revisit constantly with regards to student speech, groups coming to campus, et cetera, et cetera. This just actually locally made the national news because there was a group in a public school setting here that was discussing two genders and anyway, whether or not that was a violation of that school system's policies regarding groups coming to campus to campuses to speak. And any thoughts, suggestions, advice is where, because this can create such a firestorm of negative publicity for our institutions. And I know administrators are always really walking those fine lines. So, you know, consulting with legal counsel, making sure we're constantly reviewing those policies, tabletop exercise. Just what are your kind of recommendations for keeping sharp in that space, if that makes sense?
All of the above. I mean, I think it's important to watch what case law is coming down in your jurisdiction, so you understand, what is your federal district court saying? What is the appeals court saying? Over top of it, things are going to filter up into the Supreme Court of the United States over the next couple of years. So we just need to be careful of what case law is being issued that applies directly to our campus. Definitely be consult with legal counsel early and often as the incident is unfolding. I think that's helpful to just give you some guideposts, and then you can use your excellent judgment as an administrator to be able to figure out how to deal with the humans and move forward based on kind of what the legal guideposts are. Policies, if you haven't redone your policy in a few years on, protests and that sort of thing, it's definitely something that you want to revisit at this point. We went through a time back in the 2016 to 2020 range where a lot of folks revisited those, but you definitely want to make sure that you're paying attention to that. And then also make sure that people on the ground know those policies, right? It doesn't do any good in the world if you have the best policy, but then the police officer that's dispatched to the scene does something completely different and unauthorized. And then all of a sudden we're trying to deal with that. And it can really set the tone for how the community views the interaction. So train, 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 train. If you want, you're absolutely right with tabletop exercises. We do a lot of tabletop exercises with institutions where we put together a crisis situation and we bring together the team that would be addressing the crisis. So do we have a police officer there? Do we have somebody from student affairs, president, provost? Who's your Clery Act person who's trying to decide whether to issue emergency notifications, and how are they all communicating together and sharing information? Because a lot of times when you start working through those tabletop exercises, people at the table realize, oh, you mean you have information or something that might help me in this moment. I was only looking at it from my perspective. And so I think the more you do those conversations, the better it is.
And just to reiterate what you've said, it's so important that all of those groups be able to communicate so well. We've been hearing a lot about the importance of, you know, examining group dynamics, like working through any challenges, you know, communication challenges or things like that well ahead of time, so that when we are presented with the situation, because I think more and more folks are looking to make sure that institutions have to respond. You know,
Yes. And that even gets complicated. I mean, what do you do when you're trying to protect your campus, but the protesters are on public property off your campus, right? Like, then who are we talking to? Are we doing any tabletop exercises with whoever has jurisdiction on the other side of the street, right? In order to be able to cooperate. They're just things that are coming up now that I think we're institutions of higher education are being held to different standards sometimes than what we were used to in terms of how to control situations like that.
Bless us all. All right. Well, with that, we'll move on to this next question. You know, and I'm keenly aware of, I do live in Virginia, so obviously lots of institutions in my state seem to be making the news, whether I want them to or not. Lots of federal investigations of DEI policies. George Mason has been kind of the second after UVA in our state that this has become, I think, a weekly piece of news cycles. You know, these race-conscious practices, are they violating Title VI or other civil rights laws? I know SCOTUS is in session, and I understand that one of the cases they're hearing may kind of end the Voting Rights Act, which is interesting because I think that layers into all of this, right? I mean, the Voting Rights Act very much came out of the civil rights era, and civil rights laws. So Paula, what should we be considering here as we look at this kind of chunk, lump, pile of challenges?
Yes. So when I sit down and talk with campuses about DEI, there's kind of three buckets I tell them to throw everything in. The first one is, are we doing anything that's illegal and that has been illegal for a long time? And so if we are making decisions on the basis of race, we need to stop doing that. And that was also true under the Biden administration, right? And I think at some point there was maybe a benevolence of like, well, if I'm doing it for a good reason, then it's okay. And there has been benevolence in many circumstances over the years. I'm not sure that it's ever really gone well in the end for folks, because it does, then force, let's say you have a program for people of one race and you are excluding people of other races, it does mean that we are looking at people differently on the basis of race. And I believe we've talked about that in the courts to say that, that by itself is problematic, right? That by itself can make other people feel bad and affect the way they interact with our educational institutions. And by that, I'm referring to Brown versus Board of Education, right? So we've had these things. And so I think we have to stop the things that were illegal in the first place. The second bucket of stuff is the things that look illegal but aren't. So we're describing them in ways that sound like we are discriminating on the basis of race when we're really not. We stopped doing it that way years ago and just never updated our materials or things like that. So I tell institutions, stop doing the stuff that's illegal, then look through what you're doing and make sure that none of it sounds illegal, right? Like that's problematic too. We should just be describing things accurately. So let's make sure that what we're doing, we're describing accurately, so it doesn't look like we're doing something illegal when we're really not. The third category is everything else that, touches race in any way, shape, or form, right? You're still allowed to talk about race, assuming we still have First Amendment rights, right? Like we're allowed to have those discussions. And in fact, they may be important discussions to have. They are important discussions to have. And so there, I think there's a sense, I think there's a different position on the spectrum of what's permissible speech. I think that's what's going on. Higher ed would say this is permissible speech, and then we don't do this discrimination and harassment on the basis of race piece. And I think the US Department of Education is saying, well, maybe more like this is permissible speech, and the rest of this is something that we find in violation. The devil's in the details, right? So we're setting our standards here, and the US Department of Education is now enforcing into those standards and saying that's not okay. I can't do anything to fix that, right? Because it's enforcement priorities for the US Department of Education. I think that's where all the lawsuits come from, right? We think this is okay, but there is some sense out there, and there has been since January 20th, that if you use certain words, it's automatically not allowed, right? Diversity itself does not violate Title VI, and equity is kind of the point of Title VI, right? So an inclusion is written into certain laws as a requirement, like in our special education laws for, ages 3 to 21. So we know that those words themselves don't necessarily mean that something is illegal, but I think there is some oversimplification going on that is finding the use of certain words to be problematic. And so that third bucket is, what do we want to do here? We're running risks for our institution if we do stuff like that. If we put out there that we have a DEI office. And so maybe it comes back to what I recommended for the second bucket. It's, do you want to continue using that word, knowing that some people interpret it differently, or do we want to be really clear about what we're doing? And maybe in that case, we step back. What are we doing here? And how can we make it clear to people what we're doing here and that it's not, in fact, illegal? And that comes with a lot of big feelings, right? Are we anticipatorily complying with something that is oppressive, right? I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the longer you can keep federal funding flowing to your students, the more likely it is that your institution can remain open. And so there are lots of different things that different campuses may balance in different ways.
We talked about before we hit record just this morning, and inside higher ed, one of the news articles was about a program at the University of Nevada, Reno, I think, campus that is specifically to support undocumented students, and that these programs are replicated like in many different states. And they have received notification that it's a program that needs to be shut down because it is in violation of, I think, executive orders. And if I'm remembering the article correctly, and the president of the university is actually quoted in the piece saying that this is not a program that receives state or federal funding. It is, funded through other sources. And so I had the, pretty simple question. Well, how can we go after, if it's not federally funded, it's not state funded, how can that kind of program come under question here? And you had some very wise thoughts about how that could be in language that I was not familiar with.
Yeah, so there's kind of two things. The way you just described it was a little bit more than you gave me beforehand, and so I'm thinking two things. Number one, the restrictions don't apply to programs; they apply to entire entities. So if the university receives federal funding, the whole everything, the whole shebang, is subject to the restrictions, right? So if somebody wants to say this program is violating something that's federal law, then the whole university is in violation of federal law, and you can't just say, "Well,
Interesting.
this is privately funded, so it's," which is the
Right,
same. I mean,
right.
you think about it, right? Like if they build, a gold-plated baseball stadium, and give the women's softball team, a sand pit, it doesn't matter that it was privately funded to give them the gold-plated stadium, right? So this is something that we're familiar with. It's just we're not usually thinking about it in this capacity. The other thing is, as a public institution, most states have requirements that if there are public funds, they have to be spent for a proper public purpose. And proper is a weasel word, right? As it can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. So you put it in there and then you can interpret it how you want it later. And I suspect the university is interpreting in one way and the people enforcing against them are interpreting it another way. So it's usually not enough to say private funding doesn't matter. The difference would be if the whole institution has no public funding at all, no federal funding, no state funding. That's different, right? Because then we know, and there are certain institutions that have opted out of those sorts of programs, then we know that those federal statutes of discrimination don't apply. And right, what you can't discriminate or we'll take federal funds. Well, if you don't get federal funds, it's a different statutory scheme.
Fascinating. I mean, it's horribly challenging and it makes your brain hurt, but
Yeah.
it is interesting to kind of understand the layers here. So
Yeah, and
complex.
I would say too, like I was so the spring regulatory agenda was just released, and yes, it was supposed to come out in the spring, but it's not uncommon for there to be delays in these regulatory agendas. And if you're not familiar with regulatory agendas, it's basically the federal government puts out and says, this is what each of our agencies is intending to do with regard to regulations. Are we trying to figure out, if we're going to propose a rule in this category? Are we in fact proposing a rule? Are we planning to finalize a rule that had already been proposed? What are we doing here, right? And so we use those as lawyers to say, okay, what's coming down the pike? What are we looking at that's going to happen next? And this year, the regulatory agenda was incredibly short from the U.S. Department of Education. And almost everything on the list included some sort of update to regulations about how to take away the funding and enforce the regulations, right? So previously we have laws about how we can enforce federal fund or federal requirements and take away funds. There are procedural requirements. Some of the lawsuits out there have been because those procedural requirements were not followed, or at least that's the allegation in the lawsuit. So it looks like there may be some changes to the regulations being proposed that would maybe change that process for how they can take away federal funds. So I think that's where we're going to see the action in the next 6 months to a year. We're going to see regulations change. We're going to continue to see the threat of federal fund removal in a hope to get institutions to kind of go in the direction that they want. And on the flip side, then we have that compact, right, that you mentioned
Yes. Yeah.
earlier, that's like dangling a carrot. We will give you these unspecified benefits if you agree to this compact. And so far, I haven't seen any institution that's come out and been like, that sounds like a great plan. Instead, I've seen a lot of, yeah, I don't think so. With most recently, I think it was MIT's president came out today and said, yeah, we're not sure this is consistent with our values. So it'll be curious to see. But they're telling us what they want institutions to do. I think if you take this compact, they're going to give you stuff, whatever that means. But if you're not subject to the compact, I don't think they're looking for any different goals for any of the institutions. They're just going to use different mechanisms to get you there.
So if folks don't know about the compact, can we speak a little bit to. It's at the moment, it's nine institutions. I think the University of Texas is the only one that's spoken more favorably
Okay.
towards the compact. But the compact outlines certain, what's the right word? Processes, policies, procedures that
Yeah, like
institutions.
kind of
Go ahead.
value statements that they have
Okay.
to sign on to, maybe.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and there's, so it's called, officially, it's called the Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education. And as you mentioned, it was sent out to nine different institutions. It has different categories. So, like, for example, the first category is equality in admissions. It says, you know, that we want, it has some kind of moral language in there about how we want admissions to be done at institutions. And then it has this sentence, therefore, no factors such as sex, ethnicity, race, nationality, political views, sexual orientation, gender identity, religious associations, or proxies for any of those factors shall be considered explicitly or implicitly in any decision related to undergraduate or graduate student admissions. The sentence goes on. What does political view mean? Does that mean if you're registered as a Republican or a Democrat? Does that mean if you are, you know, anti-fascist? Does that mean if you support Israel or don't support Israel? I don't know what that means. It's not something that is currently really fleshed out for our higher ed institutions in federal law. You know, we're allowed to discriminate on the basis of political views, I suppose, because it's not otherwise prohibited, although some states do actually prohibit that. But what does that mean? I don't know, right? And these agreements come with unspecified benefits in the cover letter, but then also they're enforced by the Department of Justice. So if they feel like you're not doing something correctly, I don't know that we have a lot of guidance for what that means. And we do have an enforcement mechanism designed to take away whatever these extra benefits are that haven't been fleshed out yet.
How does this tie to the Supreme Court decision? I mean, it feels like we've already said in some ways we can't consider race, right? And I'm not saying this to be, it's going to kind of come across as a smart aleck. Truly not meaning that, but you know, the Department of Education, we know, has the U.S. Department of Education has been very much impacted by layoffs and people jobs that have been eliminated. And so my understanding is that one of the new requirements is from, I think, from that same department, is that institutions will have to provide more detailed reporting with regards to admission processes and who is enrolling and collecting data around things like race. But I'm confused by that when I thought we weren't supposed to be. Am I?
So you can collect demographics, and I suppose the demographics would be like to make sure you're not discriminating on the basis of race, right? So the statistics are going to be used to determine compliance, right? So collecting the information and turning it over to the federal government is really just going to be, are you complying? So if we're seeing that, you know, I mean, one of the things in this compact is you're going to have to give an SAT or an ACT or something of that nature if you sign on to this compact, and you have to report the results by different demographic categories, right? So if you are admitting, you know, 50% of this certain racial minority, but when we look at their SAT and ACT categories, they are, you know, I don't know, with some standard of deviation right away from what the rest of it is in a negative way, they're going to say, well, why are you admitting 50% if it's not matching up with these statistics, right? So it gives the government some arguments to make that you are not complying. You know, I would say the compact, it mentions race, but it really doesn't, like, that's not the thrust of the compact. The compact is really more about political ideas, right? And preserving the ability to have political ideas. So, like, compact number two, marketplace of ideas and civil discourse, they talk about signatories are committing themselves to revise governance structures as necessary to create a vibrant marketplace of ideas, including but not limited to transforming or abolishing institutional units that purposely punish, belittle, and even spark violence against conservative ideas, right? Or they're going to have conditions of civility, including protections against institutional punishment or individuals' harassment for one's views. This gets complicated when you say, are they protecting conservative ideas, or are they, how will this be applied to some of the disputes we're seeing in the Title VI space with regard to the conflict between Israel and Gaza, right? Like, and they're looking at disruptions and intimidating behavior. It's so much here. Institutional neutrality, they're going to require signatories to abstain from actions or speech relating to societal and political events, except in cases which external events have a direct impact on the university. When we're dealing with foreign students, they want institutions who sign on to this to vet the foreign students, to screen out students who demonstrate hostility to the United States, its allies, or its values, right? So to me, when I look at this compact, it seems to be very focused on political speech and discrimination on the basis of political speech, which makes it above and beyond what the statutory requirements are for these institutions. But that's really, you know, government saying, if you want to do this, we'll give you more money. Right. So it's not tied as closely to restrictions of statutory discrimination.
You speak about students, international students, and that's definitely been in the news. I mean, we've seen, you know, a significant decrease in the number of international students enrolling this fall semester. And then latest news, and this is hit locally very much, the desired increase in an HB1 visa, a fee that was $2,000 to $3,000-ish, maybe $5,000, will now be $100,000, and which has a direct impact on our higher ed institutions that are often bringing in.
There's some question as to whether it's going to be applied to higher ed institutions or whether they're going to be exempt from it, because they're exempt under the H-1B cap. So it's like it's uncertainty. And that's what a lot of this is, right? It's creating uncertainty that makes it hard for institutions to plan.
Right.
And hard for humans to plan, right? Like, am I moving my family? Am I doing this? Am I doing that? So that we're not quite sure how that one's going to shake out yet.
If you could gaze into a crystal ball, Melissa, when would you predict we might have some understanding or better clarity regarding that in particular? Because I'm looking at institutions like the University of Washington this week, or not the university, it may be WashU, apologies, I can't remember. One of institution announced major layoffs as a result of some concern of this because they have high in numbers of H-1 visas.
I don't know. I'm not an immigration attorney, so I don't follow that as closely. But I also haven't seen anything new suggesting. I think the last time I dug into that, they were waiting for guidance that would help hopefully explain. And the initial round of guidance that came out literally like within 24 hours afterwards didn't address that issue. So I don't think they've had that guidance come out since.
Okay. Well, we won't hold you to any prediction. but I will ask you to predict some other things. So SCOTUS, like, they're in session. You know, we know, I think I'd love for you to talk a little bit about a transgender case that's before the Supreme Court. My understanding is that was two cases, potentially it's now going to only be one case, and just those implications for higher ed institutions for Title IX. But it seems like the bigger thing that may be impacting higher ed with Supreme Court this session is really the shadow docket, which I feel like if any of us are NPR listeners, we're hearing a lot about the shadow docket. So, So I'll stop there and just look forward to your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on the shadow docket. There are people who do a phenomenal job on that and are suddenly very popular, right? Because this thing that just wasn't something that really affected the country as much is now becoming really important in terms of when stays are issued and that sort of thing. I have no predictions on the shadow docket. I'm not even sure I really understand it. It's complex, and I know that it's affecting when stays are issued and when stays can go forward. And so I'm just trying to keep my best, understand what is the current status of things and whether a stay is in place. And there's a number of litigation trackers that have helped with that online, where you can go and kind of see where the stays are and where there's the stay request is pending. I have no rhyme or reason for this. I feel like everything I learned in law school and in all of my years of experience has kind of gone out the window, because processes are not happening the way that they had before, and it makes it difficult to predict anything. So like the Title IX, the disputes about transgender athletes, right? At this point, we have states weighing in on this. We have the NCAA weighing in on this. We have the athletes. We have states that are fighting it tooth and nail to allow transgender women athletes to participate on women's teams. We have states that are going the opposite direction and passing legislation and really fighting that anything is other than sex assigned at birth, and in terms of athletic eligibility, at least on women's teams. There doesn't seem to be as much fuss about who participates on men's teams. But I will note in the compact, there was an interesting statement that stuck out at me. Let me find it. This is from number six in the compact. So again, this is voluntary for schools to sign in on if they want, but I think it gives us a good idea of where things are going. And the statement says, women's equality requires single sex spaces. And I've been letting that sit with me, because I'm not sure that is something that I would have articulated that I needed as a woman to feel equal, but it is something that someone has articulated that they needed to feel equal, and I think I need to ponder that more. So the full sentence reads, women's equality requires single sex spaces such as bathrooms and locker rooms and fair competition such as in sports. Institutions commit to defining and otherwise interpreting male, female, woman, and man according to reproductive function and biological processes. So I think that notion that equality requires segregation is a thing I hadn't seen put quite that way before, at least not in the last 100 years.
And you think about the history of higher education, focusing on this space.
So it's just
And
interesting.
the long work to make spaces not segregated in many ways, right? That we can interpret that. That's very interesting.
So my head just kind of exploded when I read that. And I was like, huh, I need to really think more about that concept being put forward and what that means for higher ed.
Wow, that's well, Melissa, I feel like I need your t-shirt, which says it's fine.
I know,
It's all
yeah, it's a podcast, right? So you can't say, but it says it's fine, I'm fine, everything is fine. Yes, that's
I feel like we needed that message. So
okay.
to wrap us up, what should we be kind of thinking about, paying attention to as we exit 2025? Because I mean, I know it's October, but just this morning, my Peloton app reminded me I only had 83 days left in 2025 to be able to meet my milestone markers.
Oh, my Peloton app gave up on me a long time ago. Right now it's complicated. Right now we're 9 days into a federal shutdown. The longest that we've seen before is 34 days. That was under the last Trump administration. It is not entirely out of possibility that we could end the year still in shutdown. I don't know what that would look like, right? So I think we're watching, I think the last statistic I said 87% of the US Department of Education's employees have been furloughed due to the shutdown, right? So nothing is happening, which means the things that are happening are the things that are still fully funded, which is why we're talking about all of the ICE actions and federal using military troops for law enforcement purposes or to provide security to ICE. Those are things that I don't think we can ignore. And that's also where the action is right now. So I think we're going to see a lot of lawsuits come out of those sorts of things. There's already a lot of lawsuits coming out of those sorts of things in terms of when can the federal government activate the National Guard and then send them to other states or in terms of their own states. So I think some of those things are going to be the hot topics. First Amendment stuff is still going to be an issue. It's still going to be a subject of discussion, but right now there's not enough people to enforce those things. So I think we will see less action on that, and we will shift more towards what's being funded at the moment. That means when the shutdown happens, there's going to be a backlog. It's going to take a hot second to work through that. And then I think we're probably going to see more action in terms of First Amendment and DEI. But also what I've seen is a lot of press release progress, right? So we issue a press release and then maybe we don't follow through with it, or we don't follow through with it immediately, and we're still waiting for things. So, for example, I have some clients down in Florida who are, you know, the government says we're going to end the immunization requirements, and they say, what is that going to mean for the people that are coming in? And the answer for me is still, I don't know, because we need legislation for that, and I haven't seen it yet, so I can't really tell you what's going on, right? So a lot of that, like, let's make a bump with a press release, and then maybe we don't have a lot of information to dig our teeth into about what that means. And then that always raises the question of if and when will we have information about that, or will they have moved on after they've gotten their initial press release? I don't know. It's so different from the way things functioned before that we don't have a lot of precedent to draw our answers from. So, you know, lots of news, lots of podcasts, watch the courts, and then stay safe out there. I mean, is really my biggest concern right now.
Are you seeing concern in institutions that you're working with regards to ICE? I mean, that is so prevalent across our news, right? Watching various, yes, ICE enforcement. Yeah.
Well, it's not a higher ed issue as much as it's just a national issue. It's, you know, right. You go to the grocery store and it might be an issue. And so I worry that all of the humans on our campuses are going to be affected in different ways by some of the things that are happening, and how do we support them as humans as they go through these things?
Listen, that's such a kind of a nice space to pause for a second, because next month on the 14th of November, we're actually, our podcast is going to be about how we can, as caregivers, take care of ourselves. And so I think you really hit on that. I think so much of this is impacting those of us doing the work of supporting students. And, you know, I had a student I taught who's been removed from the United States. And so how did I support her and the grief of losing her from a classroom space where she was just fantastic? And so that's a tiny microcosm example of things that are being replicated across our campuses. So I hope folks will join us on the 14th for that conversation. So Melissa, that was a nice cue up for the direction we're kind of moving in for next month.
That's a good one. You can't pour from an empty cup, as they say, right?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I do want to let folks know, if you're listening in, I've put our survey in the chat because we always do appreciate your feedback. That helps us shape content. The 7th of November, we're going to be in this space again, but talking about trends in dual enrollment. We were supposed to do that last month, and unfortunately, our speaker was ill, but don't worry, we're going to continue. It's an interesting space in higher ed that we're seeing a lot of exciting growth around and some challenges as well. So Melissa, I just want to say thank you so much for your time, your continued sense of balance and humor in a very uncertain space at the moment. And thank you for the opportunity to spend some time with you on a Friday. I don't think there's much that's better than that. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. I do enjoy our conversations.
Well, everybody, I hope you have a fantastic weekend. And we're getting some thank yous. Amber said thank you for making such a complicated, frustrating topic easier to understand. And I am always grateful for that as well, because these are incredibly complex situations. And so thanks for not making me have to be the legal expert. Just want to.
No problem. Anytime.
For taking that one on. I hope everybody has opportunity for rest and renewal this weekend. We need it so very much. So take care of yourselves, and we look forward to seeing you soon. Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks.
Friday Five Live is brought to you by Innovative Educators. Innovative Educators offers 6 online services for your onboarding support and training needs. Visit us at innovativeeducators.org to see how we can support your student success initiatives.